knew this plane was going down. That it, and it wasn't because there were flames coming out of its jets, but it was the way it was banking around and the way it was descending so quickly.
155 people, a flock of birds, a pilot, and a co-pilot. How does it all end? Miraculously, with a flight full of survivors. Now that's a story. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, January 16th. I'm Adora Udoji. John Hockenberry is away, but our takeaway pal, Todd Zwillick, is here in the studio and will be with us the whole hour. Good morning, Todd.
Hi. Good morning, Adora. Well, President-elect Barack Obama now has a new pile of money and a plan to get more. We'll have a conversation on his ideas about how to fix the economy, and we'll talk to someone in the middle of the Middle East conflict and the peace process on whether new developments could lead to a Gaza ceasefire. Those stories and more are coming up, but first, let's go back to Femi Oke for the latest headlines.
Good morning, all. The ordeal may be over for passengers and crew of the plane that landed in New York's Hudson River yesterday, but for investigators, it's just the beginning. Transportation safety teams will comb through the wreckage still floating in the water, and they're looking for answers as to why both engines went out, forcing an emergency landing. There's hope that a ceasefire for Gaza may be close. Top Israelis are abroad for high-level talks that could signal a readiness for a deal. The foreign minister is in Washington today, and the country's top negotiator is in Cairo, talking about an Egyptian peace proposal. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urges Hamas and Israel to end the fighting in the Gaza Strip.
The time has come for the violence to stop and for us to change fundamentally the dynamics in Gaza and to pursue again the peace talks for a two-state solution.
Some 1,100 Palestinians and 13 Israelis have died in the current conflict. Thursday was a day of farewells in Washington. President Bush said goodbye in a primetime speech.
I have followed my conscience and done what I thought was right. You may not agree with some of the tough decisions I have made, but I hope you can agree that I was willing to make the tough decisions.
Vice President-elect Joe Biden and Secretary of State choice Hillary Clinton both spoke on the Senate floor. The next president now has a new tool for the tough task of fixing the struggling economy. Lawmakers have approved releasing the remaining $350 billion in bailout funds. Adore.
Thanks very much, Femi. Yesterday on Wall Street, the Dow and the S&P were both up, but only a little bit. The Dow closed at 82.12 and the S&P finished at 8.43. And that plane crash here in New York City got us thinking about modern miracles. Very dramatic landing of a plane on the water and everyone survives. Now, your story doesn't have to be so dramatic, but tell us when you emerged from a situation that just looked like it was going to be catastrophic, but ended up turning out for the best, in a good way. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, President-elect Barack Obama can start making plans on how to spend the second half of the $700 billion bailout plan he's been lobbying for. The Senate agreed to release it, but with conditions. Todd Zwillick, reporter from Capital News Connection, joins us this morning. He's here in the studio, and he'll be with us for the hour. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Obama, he gets the $350 billion, but what are the conditions?
Well, Republicans especially were gunning for these conditions in the Senate. What they are, essentially the big one is, I agree to spend this money on the financial markets and the housing markets. No extraneous bailouts, no more auto bailouts, no industrial policy being made in the TARP fund. So no bailouts for motorcycle makers or anyone else. This is for the financial institutions and housing. Another one of the conditions is that the White House will insist that any financial institution that receives this money has to put some of the money towards what's called foreclosure mitigation. What that means is helping people stay in their homes.
Which was something that Democrats were really pushing in Congress.
They were, and they were really upset when it didn't happen in the first half. A lot of Republicans were upset about that, too. And then the other big thing is banks that get the money have to use the money for foreclosure mitigation, and also money goes directly from the TARP fund up to $100 billion directly to help for homeowners, helping people stay in their homes, covering foreclosed mortgages, things like that.
How is it that the Senate could approve releasing this money? Did the House or does the House have any role?
They do, but do you remember the concept of a double negative in school? That's what this was. It was a double negative. The Senate voted on a resolution to reject the funds. So had they voted yes, the funds would have been rejected. But they voted it down. That means it passes. Both houses of Congress have to approve it. The president would have had to sign it. So the fact that
we're going to get into the minutia there of how things work in Washington, but the Barack Obama administration, when they go to work on Wednesday, they'll have this money to spend. And of course, at the same time, they are still building the stimulus package, which we understand is at a $825 billion point.
That's exactly right. And that's the next step. Well, on the stimulus, and it's a big deal, I want to turn to the New York Times' David Hersenhorn, who's my colleague on Capitol Hill and my pal. David, are you there?
I'm here. How are you, Todd?
I'm very well. How are you this morning?
Good.
Well, David, $825 billion. Barack Obama lobbied really hard to get the plan on paper, and now he's got it, at least in the House. Did he get everything he wanted from his fellow Democrats in the House?
He's gotten a lot, but the short answer is we still don't know. In fact, I just got email from a reader of the New York Times who's been building a spreadsheet coming through that bill, and certainly some of us have been doing the same thing. And you know, it's pretty hard to count up to $825 billion, so we're still working on it. But the signature component for Mr. Obama, we would think, is what he's calling the making work pay tax cut. That's actually a promise that he made on the campaign trail to deliver middle-class tax relief, under which individuals would get up to $500, married couples, families up to $1,000. And there'll be some debate about that, because although it does keep his campaign promise, even some liberal economists say that it may not be the best long-term way to do tax policy, that it's still a little bit gimmicky. You might actually prefer to somehow reduce the tax rates at the lowest end of the spectrum and deliver longer-term, more lasting tax relief to the folks who need it most.
So there's the big middle-class tax cut there, but one big question that was asked in the campaign and still gets asked around the halls of Congress is, who is middle class? Who qualifies as middle class? And this tax cut is sort of going to define who's middle class. So who are they? How much do you have to make, or how little do you have to make to be middle class?
Well, the benchmark has been that it would completely phase out for anyone making $200,000 or more, or any family making $200,000 or more. But again, these are the fine points that will be debated. There will be a phase out, right? So that $1,000 per family credit will drop as income rises, probably over above $150,000. And again, the Senate's working on its own version of the stimulus plan. And already you hear different numbers on the Senate side than we've heard in the House. So it's going to be a fun couple of weeks as the details get hashed out.
And there certainly are a lot of details, David. And there is this goal of getting this legislation to President Obama by February 13th. Is that looking more or less likely, or is it just too much to go through before they'll know if they get to that date?
Well, to the extent that Congress can ever be, you know, on track and on schedule, they seem to be in this case. The Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, has said if they don't have a bill passed by the President's Day recess, there will be no President's Day recess. A big lift, obviously, from yesterday's approval by the Senate, or disapproval of the disapproval, as Todd explained it, for the TARP funds. If that had become a long, drawn-out legislative fight where Barack Obama was potentially vetoing a disapproval motion in his first week in office, the stimulus certainly could have been pushed back. The really interesting thing there is a lot of the conditions that Todd was describing that the Obama administration agreed to were intended to shore up Democratic votes. And so there were Republicans, including the leader, Mitch McConnell, who went to the floor and made clear some of those assurances cost Republican support because they might have released the money without some of what the new White House says it's going to do.
And in the House next week, David, I understand that they're going to vote to reject the TARP funds anyway, even though it's quite irrelevant. Why are they doing that? Why is Nancy Pelosi holding that vote?
It's really a question of, you know, this has been so unpopular. There have been so many folks who you know have been upset at the way this program has been mismanaged by the Bush administration that there are lawmakers who just want to get their vote on record.
So that if we get 2 years down the line and the diagnosis is that the TARP miserably failed, they can say, hey, look, I voted against it.
I would have blocked it. That's right. I mean, it is a moot point, as you described. To block this money, both the House and the Senate would have had to disapprove it. The Senate has said, let the money flow. But, you know, part of this goes back to the Democrats' own success in this past election, where Chuck Schumer, who led the Democratic Senatorial Committee, had many of his candidates running ads, you know, smashing and bashing their opponents over the original bailout fund. And so it's not surprising that having seen people get beat up so badly for supporting this program and now not having a Republican White House to back up, that there are a number of Republicans who are saying, you know, this just doesn't fit with our principles of how economics ought to work, and we're not going to back it. And because it's what's called a privileged motion, they can insist on the vote even though it won't really matter, other than, as you said, for their own, you know, for their own boasting down the line.
Yeah, I was thinking of the 30-second campaign commercials just the same. if this thing fails, you know, here we are. We just had an election, and we're headed for people already worrying about what the next campaign commercials are going to look like if they vote for something that's too unpopular.
And maybe one of the more remarkable things about the Senate vote last night was how all but one of the Democratic freshmen voted in favor of releasing this money, some of whom, including the Senators Udall, the cousin senators from New Mexico and Colorado, who had opposed it in the fall, supported it in part largely because of personal entreaties by the president-elect, who really threw himself into this. So it's
David, is this a symbol of Barack Obama's persuasion abilities, or is this a win for the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid?
It's a little bit of both. I think it would have been a much bigger defeat had this gone down, a much bigger complication. You know, at this point, there's pretty general agreement that the credit markets are fragile, right? We hear new news of trouble at Bank of America and Citigroup planning to break itself apart. So nobody was disputing. Even Bob Corker, who was, you know, a big player in trying to get this auto bailout done and was very angry that the bailout money got used for the auto industry, says, look, I'm a guy who knows and will tell you the credit markets are in trouble. We really need to stabilize these banks. This is very necessary. But, you know, I just don't like the fact that there are no assurances for how this money is going to be used. So, you know, it's a victory. Certainly the Obama administration is portraying it as a big victory. And if you consider that they're not even in office, that, you know, he had to push for this without having all the official trappings. You know, he's not sitting in the Oval Office yet. They really worked it hard, you know, multiple visits up to Capitol Hill, lots of phone calls trying to make sure that this would be in place so they can respond if there's some unexpected disaster in the banking sector.
So what's the next step on the stimulus?
On the stimulus, well, the House Appropriations Committee will start working in detail on the bill next week. also, Republicans, remember, the president-elect has promised a bipartisan effort here. And what we saw yesterday was really the Democratic draft, the Democratic proposal. Republicans quickly pointed out that this was not, you know, the package that included their ideas. They have ideas. They want to share them. The president-elect's agreed to hear them. So I think we'll see the Republicans begin to march out a lot of what they're pushing for, including broader and deeper tax cuts, but potentially an array of measures that would be different than what we've seen so far. And then the following week...
Right, and then it just goes on and it goes on, and we'll see what happens up to February 13th. David Herzenhorn, thanks for joining us.
Sure, great to be with you guys.
See you in the scrum, David.
See you in the scrum. David Herzenhorn is a New York Times reporter, and he was coming to us from Washington, D.C.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. John Hockenberry is away, and I've got Todd Zwillick here with me today. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Adora. Well, Adora, I'm pretty sure you remember 2004. I guess
I do.
You do. That's good. But do you remember the blockbuster drug Vioxx?
I remember all the commercials.
Well, that's part of the point. You would have remembered the commercials because there were a lot of them. But back in 2004, Vioxx got pulled off the market in a panic. And that was after millions of Americans had already been taking it for years. And the maker of Vioxx, which is Merck, had already sold billions of dollars worth of it, by the way. Well, that list of other drugs that have been pulled off the market since goes on and on, right up until today. And all the while, those drug ads, the ones you were talking about, ad after ad after ad, and in the case of Vioxx, or painkillers like Vioxx, Dorothy Hamill, Olympic champion, skating around and feeling great in her 40s or her 50s because her pain is gone because of the wonders of Vioxx. Well, those ads showed people like Hamill feeling great and enjoying life, hammering home a message, though. And that message was, ultimately, that our drug supply was safe and effective, and you should ask your doctor because they're safe and effective. Ask your doctor. Well, in many ways, the supply wasn't so safe and effective. And with us now is Dr. Stephen Nissen. He's chairman of the Department of Cardiovascular Medicine at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, and he's author of an essay in this week's issue of the journal Nature about problems at the Food and Drug Administration. His article's about how the new administration, the Obama administration, will have to work to solve problems at the FDA, lack of oversight. His name is also getting thrown around, I should add, as a possible new commissioner for the FDA. Dr. Nissen, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Well, Dr. Nissen, why do Americans see a barrage of ads for everything from Vioxx for pain to Avandia for diabetes, only to find out 3 or 4 years later that the drugs, in some cases, may be killing thousands with little benefit? Why does that happen?
Well, I think most of us who have been watching the FDA for a long time feel like it's a failed agency, that it really has been unable or unwilling to closely monitor both the safety and efficacy of drugs. This goes back a long way. There are many issues that have led to the current dysfunctional level of the FDA. One of them is the fact that the FDA is actually in part funded by industry.
User fees.
And it's called PDUFA.
Yep.
And this approach, which was begun in the 1990s, has led to a closer relationship between the industry that's being regulated and the regulators.
Well, that means the industry actually pays money into the FDA to fund the drug safety approval process. Doesn't that make the industry the paying customer instead of the public?
Well, that's the issue, isn't it? And, you know, the question is, who are the stakeholders here? And many of us want to return the FDA to the position where the principal stakeholder is the American people and not necessarily the regulated industry. Can you imagine if the EPA worked that way, if the biggest polluters were the ones that actually funded the EPA? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, Dr. Nissen, I've sat through probably 100 FDA advisory meetings over the years, many of them that you've participated in, and that's where drug companies present their data and august experts like you and others recommend approval or disapproval of these drugs. Is that a clean process? And if not, what's wrong with it in your view?
Well, it hasn't historically been as clean as it needs to be. There's been a lot of criticism about conflict of interest on those panels. Many of the most expert physicians have worked with industry. And I think it's important to understand that all of us, including myself, work with industry. But when you're receiving large amounts of income from industry, it does color your perception. And I think that we've got to get to the point where we create expert panels that involve people who are really not conflicted in any way. And that's another very important reform we've got to come to.
Well, of course, the industry says that there's no such thing as experts that aren't conflicted in any way because we have a private free market system and drug companies fund research and they go to consultants and everybody reviews drugs and does research. And there's no such thing as a true expert, or at least very rare to have a true expert who's completely unconflicted. Is that true?
Well, look, I've served on many FDA advisory panels. I've served on some that have done a great job. I've served on some that made some of the most bizarre decisions that you can imagine, including one that actually, after Vioxx was withdrawn, suggested that it would be okay to bring the drug back. And so I think that we can do better with FDA advisory panels, but we really have to look further. The problems are not FDA advisory panels. The problems are we have an agency that's desperately underfunded. The FDA regulates approximately $1 trillion of the economy. 25% of all consumer spending is food, drugs, and medical devices. And it does so with a budget that's one quarter the budget of the Centers for Disease Control.
And people don't realize that the FDA is really kind of a tiny agency.
It's a small agency. And what happened is, particularly during the last 8 years, is this administration has felt that they really didn't want regulation. And just as we saw a lack of regulation in the financial markets, we've seen a lack of regulation in this very important area of food, drugs, and medical devices.
Well, Dr. Nissen, I really want to thank you for joining us. We didn't even really talk about food, which is another huge issue. Food imports that the FDA is also in control of. Hopefully you'll come back and talk to us about food imports and food safety as well.
Anytime.
Stephen Nissen is the chairman of the Department of Cardiovascular Medicine at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio.
Certainly got their hands full, though, don't they?
Oh, more than full.
The FDA, it sounds like there's going to be some real examination of exactly how they go about approving drugs and then monitoring them after the fact.
And there has been for years. They've made some incremental steps at changing some of the details about how drugs are monitored or approved, but Nissen's making the point that they have a long way to go. They make a step forward and then a step back. All the time.
All right, now we're going to get some headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello, good morning. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. With less than a week to go before taking office, President-elect Barack Obama has already started working with the Senate. The Senate voted yesterday to release the remaining financial bailout funds, and the measure passed 52-42. Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says the new administration urgently needs the bailout money.
With our economy battered and further damage possibly still to come, we must give our new president every tool to try to fix this economy.
President-elect Barack Obama had lobbied hard to release that money. And now he's off to find support for his next financial package. President-elect Barack Obama is appealing directly to the public for support of his economic stimulus plan. Today, he'll speak with workers in Ohio at a company that makes wind power parts. And among other things, the $825 billion stimulus plan includes new spending to boost alternative energy. And we're waiting for some new economic numbers to be released this morning, and we'll learn the consumer price index for December in about 15 minutes' time. And in around about an hour, we'll also hear about the industrial production for last month. And investors on Wall Street don't seem to be too worried at the moment. Dow futures are up just a little bit. And finally, where shall I take you? How about frigid blasts of cold air, keeping things extremely cold from the northern plains to the northeast? Temperatures in the Dakotas, 47 below zero.
Femi, thanks on that note.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We're going to head back to the Middle East to look at the ceasefire efforts that the U.S., the U.N., and Egypt are trying to forge between Israel and Hamas on the 21st day of fighting. For more on what it's going to take to get a lasting ceasefire, we are joined now by Hanan Ashrawi. She is a Palestinian legislator, activist, and scholar who joins us from Ramallah. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Adora.
How would you describe the status of the ceasefire talks?
Well, the talks are still ongoing, so there's a flurry of activity at all levels. We just had a meeting with Ban Ki-moon. The Israeli foreign minister has gone to the States to see what it can do there. And, of course, the Egyptians have been working very hard with all parties involved, back and forth, to try to hone the Egyptian initiative, which aims at dealing with three issues, basic issues. One, bringing about a ceasefire and an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, but two, also dealing with the issue of the siege and the crossing points, lifting the siege, opening the crossing points, assuring the borders and having international participation there. And three, dealing with Palestinian domestic realities and attempting a domestic reconciliation among the different political parties and movements in Palestine.
And which do you think is the most critical issue, the most difficult or thorny?
Well, the most critical, of course, is bringing about an immediate ceasefire or a cessation of the Israeli assault on Gaza, because we are losing lives, you know, daily. Israel is killing scores of Palestinians every day. So far, 1,133 Palestinians have been killed, over 5,000 wounded, most of them severely and permanently handicapped. And it's very, very serious. So every minute counts. We need to put an end to this brutal and cruel attack on civilians, men, women, and children. Half of these people killed are women and children, basically, mainly children. So this is of the utmost urgency. But we cannot deal constantly, we brought them to deal with the latest Israeli violation, the latest escalation, the latest breakdown. We have to be able to place these things in a political context so that we can end the occupation. Because the major problem is the Israeli military occupation of Palestinian land, be it in the West Bank and Jerusalem or in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the most substantive, let's put it that way, the most strategic. But the most urgent is to save lives, is to put an end to this bloodletting, which is immoral and cruel.
And Israel, as you know, has said that they launched this offensive to shut down Hamas's continued firing of missiles into Israel. What will it take for Hamas to agree to a ceasefire?
Hamas, I think, has already agreed to a ceasefire. Well, last year it agreed to a six-month ceasefire, and it adhered to it. I'm not a Hamas member or supporter, but one has to deal with the truth, with facts. They adhered to a ceasefire for 6 months. It was Israel that assassinated about 21 Palestinians in Gaza, 26 in the West Bank, carried out incursions, and then proceeded with the most brutal blockade and siege that deprived the Gazans, the Palestinians in Gaza, from everything, including basic food, medicines, power, electricity, even water now. So, and a blockade, as you know, is an act of war. So while Hamas was trying to maintain a ceasefire and even confronted other factions that attempted to break the ceasefire, for 6 months, Israel absolutely refused and violated it with impunity. And then when Hamas said it doesn't want to renew it unless there are new terms of agreement and Israel will comply, of course, all hell broke loose.
Well, Mrs.
But
Schwartz,
the assault on Gaza was not really a sudden thing. It's been in the making for about 6 months or more, they said.
Well, Mrs. Shwari,
so it has a political objective.
Mrs. Shwari, yes. this is Todd Zwillick, and in terms of the current agreement or the pursuance of an agreement, I want to ask you, everyone from Condoleezza Rice on down has said that the goal is a lasting ceasefire here, but
yeah.
What are the chances of reaching a lasting ceasefire when it's clear, reasonably clear, that there's a deadline on this process? That deadline seems to be the inaugural on Tuesday when the United States gets a new president. Is a lasting ceasefire really the goal, or is the deadline Monday night?
I think you've put your finger on it. The timing of this attack was perfectly timed for Israeli elections, for the transition before Obama takes over, before the new administration takes over, and in many ways using the breakdown in the talk.
But if there's a deadline... Yes. And you haven't reached a lasting ceasefire threshold, what happens on Monday night?
No, I think there will be a ceasefire, but not a lasting one, because I'll tell you why. We do not see that there can be a lasting ceasefire between an occupying force and an occupied people. If you want peace and you want a cessation of hostilities, then you need to end the cause. You need to end the occupation. That's what we mean when we talk about a lasting ceasefire and the occupation bring about a withdrawal.
But you do see the possibility of a ceasefire agreement by Monday.
Yes. No, I think it's in the making. The different parties are agreeing on managing, first of all, not just the ceasefire, but Israeli withdrawal And then how do we deal with the crossing points, and how do we lift the siege from Gaza? What parties are going to be involved? Israel, the U.S. is going to be involved in terms of the Philadelphia area and Egypt.
And that's certainly going to change next week as President Barack Obama takes office. Hanan Ashrawi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hanan Ashrawi is a Palestinian legislator, activist, and scholar, and she joined us from Ramallah. Now we turn to Femi, who's got headlines.
Thank you, Adora. The time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Citigroup is reporting a fourth quarter loss of nearly $8.3 billion. They're now planning to realign their business. The bank will split into two parts. One part, Citicorp, will do traditional banking, and the other, Citi Holdings, will hold the company's riskier assets. In China, the parents of an infant who died from drinking melamine-tainted milk have accepted a compensation package. The manufacturer will pay them $29,000, according to the Chinese media, and by taking the money, they will give up any chance of suing in court. The child is one of six who died last year. Nearly 300,000 others were sickened. More on the situation in Gaza. We heard just a moment ago from the Palestinian legislator Hanan Ashrawi. We also spoke this morning to Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev. He says that Israel is close to agreeing to a ceasefire, but they don't want to settle for one that's just temporary.
We want to get this done, but we want to get this done right. And ultimately, we think that if we can achieve a ceasefire that will be sustainable, and we're working now, and one of the reasons my foreign minister, Mrs. Livni, is visiting Washington today is the other part of that. We've got to make sure that Hamas doesn't use a period of quiet just as a timeout to rearm.
Israel's foreign minister, C.B. Livni, wants to put a stop to Hamas weapons smuggling. Other Israeli diplomats are working on a ceasefire in Cairo today. And finally, President-elect Barack Obama's inauguration is drawing the stars to Washington. So just on Sunday, there's a free concert on the Mall. It will feature the likes of Bruce Springsteen, U2, Beyonce, Garth Brooks, Stevie Wonder, and Todd Zwillick.
Thank you very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Not a single person aboard the plane was killed, but the news that a flock of geese may have caused the crash has a lot of people wondering about bird strikes. And Patrick Smith, he comes to us from Somerville, Massachusetts, and he's got some thoughts on this. Patrick, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
I should mention you're also a pilot and author of Salon.com's Ask the Pilot. And so what was your reaction to this crash and this apparently heroics of the pilot and co-pilot?
Well, to be honest, I'm somewhat annoyed by all of this talk of a miracle and quote-unquote heroics. I mean, not to take away from the pilot's performance. What they did was not easy. But they did what they had to do and what they were trained to do. And to hyper-dramatize the event, I think, is to cheapen it and, in a way, is disrespectful to those in past accidents who were not so lucky. I mean, any time a jetliner crashes into the Hudson River, it's going to be and should be a big story. But I think we need to have some perspective. I mean, nobody was killed. And in a lot of ways, I think the lack of fatalities here should underscore just how safe flying is, and instead of reinforcing this false notion that it's more dangerous and hazardous than ever.
And it certainly goes to our fears. I mean, crashing in a plane is among the fears of so many people, and in part that's probably why we tend to hype these things up. But it does feel miraculous that not a single person was killed in that accident and that it was related to birds.
Well, bird strikes, as they're called, are actually quite common. A bird strike actually causing an accident, on the other hand, is extremely rare. In some ways, though, I'm not surprised. We haven't had a really serious bird-related accident since, well, the 1960s.
So explain how it happens. The birds fly into, or the plane flies into the birds, and they get in the engine?
Well, the worst place for a bird to hit an aircraft is probably inside the engine. The innards of a jet engine consist of a series of interconnected fans, compressors, and turbines that turn at thousands of RPM. And something like a bird being ingested, if it should bend or snap one of these blades, it disrupts the airflow and can throw the whole assembly off balance, resulting in anything from a mild burble to what they call a compressor stall to a total power loss. And you think, well, you know, how big deal? It's just a bird. But,
right.
You know, flying at, say, 250 knots, which is about a little more than 250 miles an hour, hitting an average-sized Canada goose will subject a plane to an impact force of over 50,000 pounds.
So it just even sounds aircraft, extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. And even though aircraft components are built to withstand bird strikes, they can only be so strong and so resilient. And the engines, in particular, tend to be very susceptible.
We have about 10 seconds, but clearly the pilot and the co-pilot did a very good job of landing that plane on the river.
No, they did an exemplary job under great pressure, and the results were very fortunate. But again, I'd just like to emphasize that they did what they were trained to do and mm-hmm. what they had to do. If you want to call them heroes, be my guest. But again, some perspective. Nobody was killed, and flying does remain exceptionally safe.
Patrick Smith, he's tough. Patrick Smith is a pilot and author of Salon.com's Ask the Pilot.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, January 16th, and Femi Okeh is here with the headlines.
Hello there. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. Unilateral ceasefire. That's what UN Chief Ban Ki-moon wants from Israel and Gaza. Israel does have several high-level ceasefire talks going on right now, but says it will not stop fighting until it's guaranteed safety from Hamas rocket attacks. The UN Secretary General made the comments during a meeting with the West Bank Palestinian leaders. He met with leaders in Israel earlier this week. Consumer prices have fallen for the third straight month. The Labour Department has just released figures for December, and consumer prices dropped by 0.7%. That's slightly smaller than the drop economists expected. President-elect Barack Obama will take office with $350 billion in government bailout money. It's the second half of the bailout bill. Congress approved it last night. The first half went to large financial firms. The Obama team says that it will use part of the new money to help homeowners facing foreclosure. Bank of America will get another $20 billion in taxpayer money. The country's largest bank already got a large government cash injection. It says it needs more money to close out its purchase of Merrill Lynch. Kenya's president is making an urgent plea for food aid as widespread famine looms. He says that mass crop failures put 10 million people in danger of starving. And now I have an update in our occasional series about piracy off the coast of Somalia.
Our occasional series?
Yes.
No, okay.
One or two a week. I don't like to make it too regular. I like to surprise you from time to time. So in our latest update, Somali pirates have released a Danish cargo ship that they've held for more than 2 months. And the release happened earlier today after the shipping company dropped a ransom payment by parachute and the ship's crew was unharmed. Now, Vice Admiral William Gortney, he's the commander of the US Naval Forces Central Command, said that there's a very clear reason why so many people off the Horn of Africa have turned to piracy.
It's all about the money. These all used to be fishermen, and now it's more lucrative to be a pirate. So we need to de-incentivize this enthusiasm to be a pirate and get him back to fishing.
And successful pirate attacks off the coast of Somalia have dropped last month as more international patrols tackled the pirates. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thanks very much, Femi. Democrats in the House of Representatives yesterday released a stimulus bill that lays out $54 billion for renewable energy. That means things like solar energy grids, electric cars, and wind power. But some of the biggest obstacles to creating sustainable energy may not be in the funding, but rather how the programs are implemented. For example, in California, there is a statewide debate over how to get green energy from one place to the other, how to transport solar power from, say, sunny regions to cooler, mountainous ones. Maria Hinojosa is a senior correspondent for Now on PBS. She's taking on She's taking a look, rather, at these issues tonight on PBS's Blueprint America. Good morning and welcome, Maria.
Hey, Adora. How are you?
Just fine. Glad to have you. What did you find out in your investigation?
We decided to take a look at, okay, if we're really going to do renewable energy, clean energy, how does it actually happen? I mean, if we're really going to do this across the country, how does it happen? Well, California is pretty much of a trendsetter in a lot of ways, and certainly on the issue of climate and environment. So we went to California, and we looked at a proposed power line around San Diego. It's called the Sunrise Power Link. And that's where it gets really interesting, Adora, because, you know, we have an image of, okay, well, let's get clean energy. But how do you exactly get clean energy? Well, it gets a lot more complicated when you're actually in a position of, all right, well, how do you deliver the energy from one place to another? And here's the central question, or one of the central questions, because there are many. Does it mean you're going to have to put up new transmission lines in order to get this energy? And that's where we found a lot of interesting stuff going on in San Diego around this, the San Diego Gas and Electric Company and its parent company, Sempra, and a little bit of what we are calling greenwashing. I don't know if a lot of people know that term, but, you know, basically a company that is a for-profit electric company, energy company, saying, this is going to be the greenest project ever. And then you're kind of like, well, maybe not so much. But the point is that what's happening in California, in Southern California, is basically can be like a cautionary tale for what's going to happen for the rest of us across the country.
So when you start talking about, first of all, you've got to generate the energy, right? And then you've got to get it to the places where it's needed. What are the most complicated obstacles in that process?
Well, there are a lot of complicated obstacles. What we wanted to do, because we do television, is that, and we wanted to make this an interesting visual story, is that we actually went out and took a look. So how do you actually harness enough solar energy to power not one or two or three, but thousands of homes? So as part of our story, we went out to Sandia National Labs, and there's a company there called Sterling Energy that's actually owned, it was bought by an Irish company. And they have, it was amazing, Adora. I was standing under a huge solar dish that was probably maybe four or five stories high, and the dish basically operates like a sunflower. It follows the sun throughout the entire day, takes all of this energy, these are all a bunch of mirrored panels, takes all of this energy in the Stirling engine where heat is converted through combustion. Don't ask me about all of that because I'm not an engineer, but, you know, through combustion into energy. Now, the problem is that, you know, how do you get all of this energy that's being accumulated in these solar farms proposed, you know, in you know, out there in the middle of nowhere, whether it's in New Mexico or California? And that's the question again. Now, Sterling Energy is saying, look, we've got this prototype, but the only way it's really going to work for us is if we have transmission lines to get this power through all of this, you know, solar farm.
And that doesn't sound so green, putting up more transmission lines.
Exactly. And here's where we found a lot of interesting things going on in San Diego, because a lot of, at first, we, you know, the way it was, this story was being spun about the Sunrise Power Link. And again, it's a story about San Diego, but we need to pay attention because it will be happening across the country. But the way it was kind of put out was, oh, you know, the environmentalists are very upset because solar panels, solar dishes are going to be put out in their, you know, beautiful lands in the backcountry, and you're going to have these wind turbines and it's going to look ugly. And actually, what a lot of the environmentalists and the activists in the San Diego area are saying is, here's the thing, we don't really trust that SDG&E and the parent company Sempra are really going to put clean energy on these transmission lines that they want to build. And then when SDG&E and Sempra were basically asked by the Public Utility Commission, well, by one commissioner, to put it in writing, to make it legally binding that they will put a majority, a substantial amount of clean energy on these lines, they wouldn't do it. They would not put it in writing. So that leaves a lot of people saying, gee, okay, so they're going to put up new transmission lines, which are huge, and then they're not even going to use it to bring in clean energy. So that's where all of us have a lot of questions that we have to be asking as this moves on in the future.
Well, Maria, this is Todd Zwillick, and there are a lot of questions. And you're talking about greenwashing going on in San Diego and across California, but this is really going on nationwide, isn't it? I just think of one example. I see ads on buses and in the metro stations all over Washington from oil companies saying, we're going green. Won't you join us? It's from a gasoline oil company essentially implying, we're green. What's wrong with you? What's your problem?
No.
Isn't that going on everywhere?
It is going on everywhere. I mean, you know, you see these wonderful, beautiful commercials that SDG&E has put out there, you know, with these sunflowers, and they're just gorgeous and blue skies. And everybody really wants to buy in to doing clean energy. And that's why we have to be that much more vigilant. Because we're so interested in wanting to make this happen across the country. And there's an interest now, certainly, with the upcoming Obama administration to make it happen quickly, that we can't forget that these are for-profit energy companies. So if
with PR companies working for them.
You got it. So that means that all of us who have the best intentions have got to work together, we've got to communicate, and we've got to really hold these people to it. And you can watch the show tonight on Now on PBS, don't forget, where we do really fascinating investigative journalism all the time.
And that's Maria doing her own PR. Blueprint America airs tonight. Maria Hinojosa is a senior correspondent for Now on PBS. Check that out. And we've been talking about the plane that crashed on the Hudson River here in New York City. Everyone made it out alive, 155 people. And we want to hear your stories of escape.
This is Doug from Massachusetts. One day I was working in my car, I had it jacked up, and everything was very icy. And all the blocks started to slide out from underneath the car. And I realized my stupidity at the last second slid out from underneath the car, and things fell down. She would have crushed me otherwise.
Now, that's a dramatic, good story. Yours doesn't have to be so dramatic, but we'd like to hear about a story where you found yourself living through something you didn't think you would. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And we're always on here at The Takeaway. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm Adora Udoji. Todd Zwillick is in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Money in my mom's hands. That's Christopher Wallace, better known as the Notorious B.I.G. As a teenager, he chose crime over the classroom, but then he put his angst into music and became a hip-hop superstar. Today, his life and death opens on the big screen. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, January 16th. I'm Adora Udoji. John Hockenberry is away, but Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection is with us from Washington. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Adora. We're headed to Jerusalem shortly to see if the Israeli government thinks a ceasefire in Gaza is near and also permanent, plus a photographer's tale of capturing the Obamas. Those stories and more are coming up, but first, let's get caught up on the latest headlines with Femi Oke.
Good morning, all. Investigators are now pulling a U.S. Airways jet out of New York's Hudson River. Their mission is to find out why both engines failed, forcing the pilot to make an emergency landing in the frigid water. At the time, he reported multiple birds hitting the plane. Everybody made it out alive, so there's high praise this morning for the pilot, crew, and rescuers. Several top diplomatic missions could signal Israel is ready for a Gaza ceasefire deal. Israel's foreign minister will be in Washington today, and high-level Israelis continue to talk in Cairo about an Egyptian peace proposal. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon met with West Bank Palestinians as part of a Middle East peace mission. He's calling for Israel to stop shooting now, but Israel has tough demands first. His former Israeli Prime Minister and opposition party leader Benjamin Netanyahu.
The ceasefire must include not merely the cessation of rocketing, complete cessation of rocketing of Israel's cities, but it must also have an effective barrier for the rearmament, the future rearmament of Hamas.
Arab League UN ambassador Yahya Mamasani says that it's past time for Israel to halt.
There is a call by the Security Council to ceasefire, immediate, durable and sustainable ceasefire. And this should be implemented. How many Palestinian women and children, how many Palestinians must fall before Israel realizes that they must implement a ceasefire?
Hamas wants a withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza and reopening of border crossings. President-elect Barack Obama now has a new tool for the tough task of fixing the struggling economy. Lawmakers have approved releasing the remaining $350 billion in bailout funds. Adora.
Thanks very much, Femi. Yesterday on Wall Street, the Dow and the S&P were both up, but only a little. The Dow closed at 8212 and the S&P finished at 843. Today, we want to hear your stories about escape. We're thinking about that plane crash here in New York City where 155 people survived. Your story doesn't have to be as dramatic, but tell us when you emerged from a situation that looked like it was going to be catastrophic, but ended well. Give us a call at 877-8MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Economist Paul Volcker, who will be a special White House advisor to the Obama administration, has unveiled a massive proposal setting out ways to restructure the global financial system. Although it's theoretical, it could provide clues to the kinds of changes the administration might push for. To get a greater understanding of this plan, we've invited Janet Tavakoli to the show. She's the founder and president of Tavakoli Structured Finance. She's also the author of a new book, Dear Mr. Buffett, What an Investor Learns 1,269 Miles from Wall Street. Good morning and welcome back, Janet.
Good morning. How are you, Adora?
Good. Changing the global financial system, that certainly sounds like a tall order. What's the premise here and how would it work?
Well, you know, Adora, that's a good question. Now, last night I read through the financial reform proposal and I'm sad to say that I had to grade it an F.
Oh.
And here's why. I mean, these, I'm sure, are well-meaning gentlemen. Paul Volcker, as you know, really his claim to fame is managing our money process and how we print money in the United States. But unfortunately, these gentlemen missed the mark. And this proposal is filled with some dodged issues, platitudes, and pablum. Now, they do have some make some good points here. But what we were looking for is a flu immunization and Tamiflu, and they gave us tea and cough drops. So I do have what needs to change, and we can go through that. But before I do that, let me talk about their proposal a little bit.
Right, because specifically, these are major, major changes, limiting the size of banks, setting guidelines for executive pay, and regulating hedge funds. I mean, this sounds something like something the markets would be allergic to.
Well, first of all, I don't disagree with some of the things that they put into this proposal, although it was a little disingenuous for them to belly up to the trough by saying that, you know, we, your failed regulators, should be on the boards of these financial institutions. That was a bit self-serving. However, limiting the bank activities to some extent is not a bad idea. And in terms of managing hedge funds and private equity funds, what we've seen is that they really weren't independent and off balance sheet because a lot of these things came right back on balance sheet, which has been a huge problem for Citigroup, for Bank of America, and for JP Morgan, but mainly for Citigroup. And they completely underestimated the effects of leverage. Now, what is unconscionable, though, are the things that this proposal does not address.
Like.
The fact that the rating agencies really should have had their NRSRO designation yanked. What do I mean by that? That they didn't follow basic statistical principles in their current rating, and that isn't addressed here. They just say we need to make the rating agencies more robust to reflect market changes, but they didn't address the fact that the rating agencies misrated securities.
And quickly explain, why is that so important?
Well, that's important because a lot of people relied on the AAA rating of rating agencies for, excuse me, I had to drink a little water, for misrated securities that ended up in our pension funds and our mutual funds, that ended up being guaranteed by bond insurers who guaranteed municipal bonds, which means now our municipalities, because of this misrating, and because it damaged the bond insurers, it makes it harder for us to borrow money for our schools, for our water pipes. This is basic stuff. And I bring this down to, and I explain this, and Dear Mr. Buffett, exactly what happened in our financial crisis. Warren Buffett and I were following this over the past 3 years. And I include our thinking and analysis in terms of what happened and what needs to change. And, you know, this has affected broadly the whole financial world because of the doubt and confusion by these misrated, mispriced products. And, you know, they really dodge that key issue here.
Janet, this is Todd Zwillick.
Hi, Todd.
Hi. Even if they were to succeed in doing things like reining in hedge funds and reining in CDOs, credit default swaps and derivatives and all of these sort of murky, scary things we've been hearing about since this crisis started, even if they succeed in doing that, isn't the capital market all about gaining advantage? Isn't it a game of whack-a-mole, basically, that if they rein these things in, that smart people will find other unregulated ways to make money and sort of get us back on the same cycle?
Ah, Todd, that is a great observation because that's why I'd like to explain what I think needs to change in order to change the incentives. Otherwise,
please
you
do.
Will play a game of whack-a-mole. And, you know, right now we're all feeling badly because a lot of people have the flu, unfortunately, the financial flu. Some institutions will die. In the meantime, a lot of them are going to feel miserable. And so how do you prevent the next flu outbreak? You know, we can't do much about people who currently have the financial flu, but how do we head off the next flu outbreak? And they did bring up some good things. For instance, we don't want investment banks commingling your money, client money, with the general funds of an investment bank and using that to leverage up even further. Also, investment banks, excuse me, were taking money, collateral, from each other for trades that they were doing, and instead of segregating that, they were using it to leverage up in some cases. And it's a good point. That should be separated out, and we should do basic banking. If we could bring Gina Begg back from the grave, the former chairman of Illinois National Bank, he could tell them all how to go back to basic banking. But in the meantime, to prevent this from happening again, we have to look at the quality of revenues, and that's paramount. A lot of these investment banks, you know, for the past several years were reporting these high revenues, but the quality of the revenues was poor. There was a lot of risk related to those revenues, and we're seeing the results
now. And not necessarily accurate either.
No, they weren't.
And there were things like buying up European sewer systems and other kinds of things just to get lousy assets off your books.
Yes, there was a lot of gamesmanship, and that's another thing that I talk about in Dear Mr. Buffett, where I talk about beware of geeks bearing grips.
Well, thanks for that, but just to bring it back around to this proposal or these ideas that Paul Volcker has put out, what do you think this tells us about where an Obama administration might go in trying to address the global financial issues?
Well, it's the same old, unfortunately. And even his appointment of Mary Shapiro, that's a horrible appointment to the SEC. She's been part of the problem for years, not part of the solution. One of the hedge fund frauds that I talk about is the Bayou hedge, the Bayou problem, and that was Sammy Israel, and that was huge. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars had gone missing when the NASD, and FINRA, rather, looked into the precursor to FINRA, looked into Bayou, and they found nothing.
Just explain to those who are not familiar with the Bayou situation.
Well, Sammy Israel was managing a hedge fund called Bayou, and apparently he wasn't really investing the money on the investors' behalf. That was the allegation. And hundreds of millions of dollars went missing. And in the course of any sort of competent audit, that would have been uncovered, but none of that was uncovered in the investigation that was done. And Mary Shapiro has long been what it seems too cozy and friendly. The conversation that she had with Gary Lynch, who was the general counsel of Morgan Stanley at the time that they were doing an investigation, just seemed a little odd, given that she had worked with him at the SEC before. A little too cozy, too friendly. I'm sure Wall Street is delighted with this appointment because it's just Christopher Cox in a dress.
Well, so ultimately, do you think that nothing will be done?
Well, now that remains to be seen, because if I were in Obama's shoes, being a new president, being untested and untried, I might make placeholder appointments so that when I got in the saddle and when I, you know, this is pre-inauguration, don't forget, once I was in the saddle and got a lay of the land, then I can start rocking the boat. But I don't know that I would do things differently in Obama's situation. I'm just wondering if he is a really good strategist and maybe waiting until after he becomes president to, you know, firmly grasp the reins, or whether he's going to go along to get along.
Okay, Janet Tavakoli, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Janet Tavakoli is the founder and president of Tavakoli Structured Finance, and she's also the author of Dear Mr. Buffett, What an Investor Learns 1,269 Miles from Wall Street. So what do you think, Todd?
I'm thinking about Chris Cox in a dress.
And?
It's not a pleasant thought. Not physically, anyway. I'm not sure if the new SEC nominee really is Chris Cox in a dress or not, but I sure hope not.
Hey, we're thinking about modern miracles today. We want to hear your story, this on the heels of the survival of 155 passengers of a plane crash here in New York City yesterday. When have you found yourself in the midst of tragedy, but it actually turned out well? We want to hear those stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. John Hockenberry is out today. I'm Todd Zwillick. And everyone take a listen to this.
Where you want to be 10 years from now?
10 years from now, where do I want to be? I want to be just living, man. Just living comfortably with my wife. You know, just laid back, just chilling. You know what I'm saying? Living.
Christopher Wallace there, Biggie Smalls. He was at the height of his rap career in the early 90s. The rise of his star, though, came to a tragic end 12 years ago when he was killed in a drive-by shooting. Christopher Wallace, the notorious B.I.G., was 24. Today, Notorious, a biopic based on Biggie Smalls' life, hits theaters nationwide. Now, for a look at what this film means for Biggie Smalls' legacy, we are joined by Valletta Wallace. She is Biggie Smalls' mom. Ms. Wallace, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're also one of the film's producers, correct?
Yes, I am.
Well, Ms. Wallace, I've heard you say that you learned things about your son's life in this film that you didn't know and that really you didn't like. That must have been a difficult thing to come by in a film that you helped produce.
Yes, it was extremely painful. But I felt it was something that I had to do because it's a project that I started. When I began this project, you know, everyone knew him as an artist, as the greatest rapper. You know, they never knew him as a father or a son or even as a man. And I felt, you know, during all this research, I found out about the man and a part of that man I never liked very much or I hadn't liked very much.
And these were things that you honestly didn't know about your son before others told stories? Was it stories from his friends or from cohorts that you didn't know, that people don't necessarily share with their moms?
Well, I found out, and during this research, I also found out that some of the friends around him knew. And that is how I came to know this. So many of the things that was out there, his friends knew about it, or his associates knew about it.
Well, you had known, I'm sure, that he did a stint in prison for drug-related charges. You must have known that. So there were other things besides just brushes with the law, I take it.
Well, I knew he was arrested. That much I knew. I knew he spent days in, I don't know if you call it prison or jail.
Jail, yeah.
But I felt that was that had to be brought out.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about the making of this film, because there were some fascinating stories about how the role of Biggie was cast. They didn't they didn't really do a traditional they didn't go to central casting for the actor to play a notorious B.I.G. Can you tell us how the role of your son was cast for this film?
Well, there was a casting call in New York City. God, so many people turned up. And then there were, you know...
But this was an open casting call. It wasn't just actors. It was people from all over the city, wasn't it, who were fans and who knew how to rap like him and thought they looked like him and could walk like him?
All over the city and all over the country. You have people from Canada came down for this casting call.
Wow.
And then, you know, they were sent in, their bios were sent in, and on that there was a particular day when they were doing some audition that I felt I had to see. And that's when this man, Jamal Woodard, walked in.
But you sat there watching auditions, I take it, watching a dozen, two dozen, maybe 50 gentlemen of various size and weight, I'm sure, because Biggie was a big guy, coming through the door to talk like him and rap like him and do his rhymes. That must have been quite an experience to see all these people who essentially had learned to be just like your boy.
It was a day beyond day. But for some reason, that second day when I went in, they never saw me. I was just sitting into a corner. So I never wanted to intimidate anyone. I felt the first day I was somewhat intimidated. You know, I intimidated a lot. But that next day, I felt I'd got to keep myself away from them. So that day, Jamal, they did not see me.
Well, the day Jamal did it, and he was, of course, chosen to play... to play Christopher Wallace in the film. The day he did it, did you know in your mind right away that he was the one, or was it more of a communal decision with the directors and the people really running the film?
When Jamal walked in, he had this old demeanor, this, you know, self-assurance, you know, within himself that I got this part. You know, it was all Biggie's. He came in as a Biggie. He had the hat, he had the glasses, he had the whole suit, he had the personality. When he rapped and, you know, George and my other producer said, okay, we'll get in touch with you, he turned to them in a very, very humble, calm way and said, thank you. And when he said thank you, he reminded me so much of my son. I said to them, that's my son there.
And you knew at that point?
I knew at that point he was my son.
Well, what would, now that the film is coming out, what would you like people to take away from the film? Of course, fans of Biggie's music get their dose from the soundtrack. There's no doubt about that. But do you think that Biggie's life carries any lessons, real lessons,
yes,
that people can take away?
Yes, it does. Because Christopher did some awful things in his life. But he had a talent. He had a wonderful talent. And for all those men, those women, those kids out there, I would like for them to use their talent. Don't focus on what was so awful. Because you know what? Good might cost a penny, but bad cost $1 million. And a penny worth of good is better than $1 million worth of bad. And I would like for them to take their talent and make it the best that they can.
Well, Notorious is the new biopic based on the life of the notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls, Christopher Wallace. Valletta Wallace is Biggie's mom. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Valletta, it's been nice talking to you. Ladies in the Place with Style and Grace. That's what Biggie said. The Takeaway has its own Lady in the Place with Style and Grace.
Oh, my goodness. She's a serious kiss-up.
We have two, as a matter of fact, Adora Udoji
We have one, actually. You can decide which one. Meanwhile, good morning. It's 28 minutes past the hour. And let me do you a quick update on some of the headlines. Just a few minutes to go before the open on Wall Street, and investors have some new economic numbers to consider. About an hour ago, we learned that consumer prices fell for the third straight month in December. It was a record drop in gasoline prices that pushed them down. And we're just waiting to hear about the industrial production numbers from last month. I will bring them to you as soon as I get them. The Senate voted yesterday to release the second half of the financial bailout funds. The measure passed 52-42. That's a quick look at your news headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
Thank you, lady.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. John Hockenberry is away, and I've got Todd Zwillick here with me today. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Adora. There's more today on the continuing conflict between Israel and Hamas. Israeli forces continued their bombardment of Gaza last night with some 40 airstrikes. A military spokesman said those airstrikes were aimed at targets including Hamas smuggling tunnels and rocket launching sites. The Israeli Foreign Minister, Tzipi Livni, is in Washington today, while senior Israeli officials return to Egypt for more talks on a possible ceasefire deal. So what is the latest and what is needed for a lasting ceasefire? Mark Regev is a spokesman for the Israeli government, and he joins us on the line from Jerusalem. Mr. Regev, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
To start off, how would you describe the status of the ceasefire talks right now?
They're still ongoing, but I think we're pretty close to the end game here.
You think we're close to the end game? In what way?
Well, I think we're getting close. I think everything's coming into place. We're not there yet, but we could be there very closely. Ultimately, our goal is a long, sustained, durable quiet in the south that's ultimately good both for Palestinians and for Israelis.
So that you believe that you're nearing not just a ceasefire that's going to last 6 months or 5 months, but you believe that you're close to hitting that threshold of what Secretary Condoleezza Rice and everyone, including yourself and even some on the Palestinian side, call a lasting ceasefire?
That's what we want. I mean, it was possible to stop the fighting before this with some sort of Band-Aid solution. But once again, there would be no point just to have it all blow up in everyone's face a week from now, a month from now. We're trying to reach a solution which will be a real solution, which means we don't have to go through all this again a year from now.
Well, that's sort of my question, because everybody seems to believe, and it seems to be the belief out there that part of the timing here is, of course, our transition of power here in the United States, and of course, the inauguration of the new president is on Tuesday. A lot of people perceive that a deadline is sort of then Monday night or Tuesday morning, and if such a deadline exists, you may get a ceasefire, but if a lasting ceasefire isn't in place by then, what do you have?
First of all, I mean, we'd like to get this done sooner rather than later, but I sit in a lot of meetings and I've never heard anyone use that deadline of January 20th. We want to get this done, but we want to get this done right. And ultimately, we think that if we can achieve a ceasefire that will be sustainable, and we're working now, and one of the reasons my foreign minister, Mrs. Livni, is visiting Washington today is the other part of that. We've got to make sure that Hamas doesn't use a period of quiet just as a timeout to rearm. And we know the Iranians will be all too eager to send more rockets to Gaza. And those rockets, of course, end up being shot into Israel at Israeli cities. So we're working on how to create mechanisms that will work, that will prevent also in the framework of the quiet, prevent Hamas from rearming.
Well, I'm interested in that because one of the main conditions for Israel, of course, has been to prevent a rearming. You just mentioned it. Egypt can certainly play a role on its border with Gaza. What physical mechanisms, what would it look like? What would happen on the ground to prevent more rockets and other armaments from getting into Hamas's hands in the interim?
I think what we're talking about are two fundamental areas here. First of all,
is obviously better security on the ground, not allowing tunnels, not allowing people to bring in weapons to the Gaza Strip. And I think a lot of work is being done there, positive work. Ultimately, our envoy, General Gilad, has been now 2 days in a row in Egypt. Those discussions are serious. Those discussions are detailed. We're not there yet, but we could be very close. There's a larger issue, though, which is, of course, Iran is quite far away. And to what extent are we able, with the help of countries like the United States and other NATO allies, to what extent can we intercept Iranian weapons before they even reach the region?
Are we talking about the coastline, for instance?
The coastline also, but even further apart. Ultimately, Iran is a force for nihilism in the region. Iran wants to stir up problems, and if we can restrict Iran's flow of weapons to their surrogates, to their proxies, whether it's Hamas in Gaza or Hezbollah in Lebanon, that's ultimately good for stability and for peace.
Well, how do those, the physical weapons, the rockets themselves and parts of bombs and things like that, assuming that they do come from Iran or its clients, how do they reach Hamas in Gaza City or in Gaza? We know about tunnels, of course, that run sometimes under the border in Sinai, the border with Egypt. How else do they get there?
Well, there were occasions where the crossings just broke down, you'll recall, the crossings between Sinai into Gaza. Obviously, a lot of very bad weaponry got through in that period. There is, of course, the sea. And what we've got to do is we've got to make sure that those openings are not open anymore. We've got to make sure that Iran can't continue to ship rockets into Gaza. That's the bottom line.
Okay, so let's project forward to Tuesday and say, speculate that you have a lasting ceasefire, one that everyone's calling lasting anyway. You're confident that arms will not easily flow into Gaza. One of the other goals at the outset of this operation was to crack Hamas or crush Hamas. Are they crushed? And if they're not crushed by the time you have a deal, can Israel live with a Hamas that still says it wants to destroy Israel but just may not have the rockets or the weaponry to cause mischief in the short term?
You know, we never talked about crushing Hamas. We never talked about regime change in Gaza. On the contrary, we were very careful.
You talked about crushing their military ability.
Exactly.
Exactly.
What we're talking about is here, I mean, I'll give you what I think are the three elements of a positive endgame. First of all, Hamas will come out of this substantially weaker militarily. We believe that our military operations, our military pressure on them has started a process of disintegrating their military machine. Excuse me, and that process continues as we speak. Secondly, we're hoping to create in the minds of Hamas leadership the understanding that if they shoot rockets at Israeli civilians, that ultimately hurts them much more than it hurts us. In other words, we want to reestablish Israeli deterrence. We want them to understand that there are serious consequences for them to shoot rockets into Israel, and therefore they won't do it. And thirdly, if we can, as I say, cut off the flow of weapons to them, we'll keep them. They won't be able to rebuild their military machine. On that basis, to use a statement once that Madeleine Albright used, we'll have Hamas in a box. And if that threat in the south of my country is neutralized, I think that will create an opportunity to move forward with the Palestinian government, with the Annapolis process. Once Hamas's ability to cause problems has been substantially neutralized, I think that will give us an opportunity to move forward in the peace process that we all ultimately want to see.
And at that point, you'll have a new president in the White House here. Well, Mark Regev on the line from Jerusalem, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Mark Regev is a spokesman for the Israeli government, and Femi Oke is here with headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President-elect Barack Obama lobbied lawmakers to get the remaining bailout money released. For his stimulus plan, he's going straight to constituents. Today, he has speak with workers in Ohio at a company that makes wind turbine parts. President Bush bid America farewell last night. His primetime speech included a defense of his policy and good wishes for President-elect Obama. And if you were wondering where all the frigid weather is coming from, here's the meteorological answer.
Should we blame the government or blame society?
Or should we blame the images on TV?
No, blame Canada! Blame Canada!
So if you're cold today, blame Canada. Forecasters say that an Arctic air mass north of the border has spilled into the lower 48, putting
That's
much of the country into a deep freeze.
Thank you, Femi.
Blame Canada.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
probably heard about China's one-child policy, but now the country's Family Planning Commission has released a survey saying that 70% of Chinese women, that's 70, wish they could have had two babies or more because they worry that only one child is likely to become lonely or spoiled. The commission just announced the survey, but here's the twist. It was conducted in 2006, but it's only being released just now. For more on the survey and what it might mean for China's one-child policy, I spoke with Quentin Somerville. He's BBC's Beijing correspondent, and I asked him how the one-child policy came about.
The interesting thing about the one-child policy is that it isn't really a one-child policy. For actually the majority of women in China, they're allowed to have more than one child. So, for example, if you're an ethnic minority in China, if you're not Han Chinese, you can have as many children if you want. Or if you're the product of a one-child family, so if you were a one-child and your husband is a one-child, you're allowed to have two children. And then in the countryside, it gets a bit complicated, but then in the countryside, if your first child is a girl, you're then allowed to try for a second child in the hope that it's a boy, because here in China, having a boy is very important. So the one-child policy really only matters in towns and in urban areas, and that's where that survey has been focused. And we see the results that many people are saying that they would rather have more than one child. But what's interesting is that Chinese people manage to separate what they want and what they believe is good for China. So often when you speak to Chinese people, they say, yes, I'd like a second child, but actually China is a very big country with 1.3 billion people with very few resources. The best thing for China is that I only have one child.
People are really convinced that their own sacrifice is for the greater good, even in forming their own families.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is that this story appeared, this survey was written up in one of the state newspapers. And one of the things that surprised me when I came to China 3.5 years ago was there is an active debate going on about the one-child policy, about how it changes, how it develops, and how China matches these needs. As people in cities get richer, many of them can afford the fines that they'd have to pay if they had a second child.
The disincentives, yeah.
Exactly. But there is this worry that we now have a generation of Chinese people who've grown up as little emperors or little empresses. They've been one child, they've grown up with two sets of grandparents, and they've been terribly spoiled. They've had all this attention from these two sets of grandparents and their parents focused on them, pouring money into them, into their education. And quite often it's made them not very nice people. And the big worry is that this is corrupting Chinese society.
Hey, I know,
and the government has to do something about that.
I know lots of people with brothers and sisters who aren't very nice people either. But let me ask you about the Chinese government. Have they seen this report? Have they reacted to it? Is there any indication that it will influence the one-child policy at all?
Well, the one-child policy really is something that seems to be up for negotiation. I mean, it's a fundamental part of Chinese society. But talking about it and discussing how it's implemented, particularly in the cities where all the money is, where there's an increasing affluence, and where more people feel that they have more choices, they're no longer part of work groups, they're no longer supervised by the state in the way they were, well, all of that seems to be up for grabs.
That was BBC correspondent Quentin Somerville, who joined us from Beijing.
Listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, January 16th, and Femi Okeh is going to get us caught up with all the headlines.
It's 30 minutes to the top of the hour, and it's Friday. A new report shows American industrial production dropped a full 2% last month. That's twice as bad as analysts feared. And that number measures how busy the nation's factories are. Also new this morning, consumer prices dropped for the third straight month in December. A record drop in gas prices was a key driver of the price plunge. The emergency landing in the Hudson River is now fully into the investigation phase. Experts are slowly pulling the wreckage of a U.S. Airways jet out of the waters off New York, and they want to know why both engines failed, forcing the pilot to make an emergency landing in water. At the time, he reported a flock of birds hitting the plane. Everybody made it out alive, so there's high praise this morning for a precise landing and a swift rescue. The murder trial for an American college student and her former Italian boyfriend begins in Italy today. It could last up to 6 months. They're charged with murdering her British roommate, and that was back in 2007. Both of them deny the accusations. A third suspect was found guilty in a fast-track trial last year. British writer John Mortimer has died at the age of 85. His most famous characters include the crabby criminal lawyer Horace Rumpole of the Bailey. Here's Mortimer's assessment of the role of the lawyer in the world.
Lawyers are unpopular, but the great criminal defender keeps all our liberties alive. He keeps jury trials alive. He keeps the burden of proof alive. And politicians, newspapers, the public are really always trying to chip away at all those liberties.
Now, Mortimer was a lawyer first and then went on to become a prolific writer of books and screenplays. And Adora, you're our legal eagle. He says that no brilliance is required in law, just common sense and relatively clean fingernails. Let's see your hands.
Is that what it is? I think it depends on who you ask. I think that's for sure. Thanks very much, Bemi.
You're welcome.
We've been thinking about modern-day miracles today, given the plane crash here in New York City and the survival of the 155 people who were aboard. And we're asking you for your stories of situations that looked like they were going to be dastardly, but actually turned out for the best.
Good morning, Takeaway. Troy from Dakota. I was driving at night to Chicago in 1994 when I fell asleep at the wheel. I woke up when I hit the gravel on the shoulder, I panicked a bit, overcorrected, rolled it about a dozen times at 80 miles per hour, wound up upside down in the ditch, belted in with only a small scratch on my knee, and I found out later that if I had landed in any other stretch of that road in the ditch, I would have hit rocks, trees, or pilings.
These stories are incredible that we have gotten today. A woman was shot. She survived. A woman was concerned about the health of a baby. The baby was fine. Anyhow, would like to hear your stories. They don't need to be that dramatic, that much of a question of life or death, but anything that you consider a modern-day miracle. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Well, Adora, in 1996, at a time when Barack Obama was on the verge of getting into politics, famed photographer Mariana Cook took pictures and interviewed him and his wife Michelle for her book called Couples, Speaking from the Heart. The pictures didn't make it into the final copy, and they were filed away, if you can believe that. But now they've been pulled out, dusted off, I'll bet you can believe that, and one of them is currently in the New Yorker magazine. Mariana Cook joins us in the studio with her story. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, don't you wish at this point in your 2020 hindsight that you had used those pictures of young Barack and Michelle Obama in the book?
I'm sure the publisher wishes.
I'm sure they do too.
They certainly belonged in the book, and I wish they'd been in it.
How many photos of the incoming first couple do you have?
I have one of him alone and one of them together. I shoot quite a few roles to end up with the final one, but I don't have any outtakes. I work very specifically, and in the course of a portrait session, it builds to a moment when everything comes together, and then it often fades away, or there's a different rhythm to a session. So I always say if a session is successful, there's one image, and if it's not successful, then you have six to choose from.
Well, how was it that you came to them? He wasn't in politics yet. He wasn't famous. Neither was she. So how were you introduced? How did you choose them?
I wish I could remember who actually recommended them. I have always photographed intellectuals and a lot of artists, writers, people in academics, people who think. I like that. And they were in that milieu, certainly. They lived in Hyde Park in Chicago, well-educated. And so they would have been in my wider circle.
Did you notice anything? Did anything strike you, or were they just an up and coming couple that you thought were thinkers and a good photo? Did you notice anything that really struck you?
Well, they were very related to the world around them. I mean, he was. I asked him what he would do if he got into politics, and he actually gave me an answer, which I could read to you if you're interested.
Very interested.
I asked him, what do you hope to accomplish when you enter political life? Because he was about to run for the state Senate. So keep in mind that this had to do with being in a state Senate. My overriding vision is driven by children and what I see happening to children. And as an African American, I end up being concerned about children in the inner cities and what is happening to them, and the complete lack of any kind of stable framework in which they can grow and develop. A lot of that is determined by economics and the life chances and opportunities that they face or their parents face. A lot of it has to do with values, things like family values that are talked about all the time and bandied about by politicians. But I think values aren't just individual. Values are collective. Children learn values from what they see around them. And if they see that their parents' lives are not valued, or that their community is not valued, if their schools are falling apart and their streets are falling apart and their homes are falling apart and people's lives are falling apart because they don't have jobs or opportunity, then it's very hard for children out of thin air to create values for themselves that can sustain them. And so I think that my priority is to restore a sense of public values or collective values to the debate. And that means recognizing that we are one big family and that across racial lines and across class lines that we have mutual obligations and mutual responsibilities. Maybe that's where the public and the private meet when it comes to couples or relationships or families or tribes, that the overriding priority in all those associations is a sense of mutual responsibility and empathy, then being able to put yourself in another person's shoes. That's how the marriage between Michelle and me sustains itself. We can imagine the other person's hopes or pains or struggles, and we have to extend that beyond just the individual families to other people.
Well, he says similar things when he gets a chance even now. But I want to ask you quickly about the physical image of Barack Obama and the physical image of the presidency, because it's such an important part of the presidency, the photograph, the television image, the still image that reaches the public. He's a master of that image, and we're starting to realize how well he presents himself and his family, how well he's photographed, and that he knows how to present himself on a set. As someone who's behind the lens looking at him, what do you think the power of that is? And is he as good at it as I seem to think he is?
Well, I would disagree with you, in fact.
Really?
Yeah, I think he's natural. I don't think it's calculated.
Well, that makes him lucky then, doesn't it?
He's lucky. I mean, yes. He's very comfortable in his own skin. I don't think too many people in the world are. And so that's something he doesn't actually have to think about or worry about. I really don't believe that it's calculated in any way.
Even in events like in Denver at the convention, where he put himself in the center of a stadium and stood tall all alone, even gave his speech without his family by his side, it was very... cult of personality is going too far, but it was an image of the personality in the man, very much so.
Yeah, I'm sure he thinks about what would be appropriate in any given situation to make the most of that situation, but may not been appropriate for him to have his family there. Maybe he didn't want them to have that experience.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Well, Marianna Cook, really appreciate you joining us. Thanks for coming in, and we look forward to seeing your photo from 1996 of a pre-political Barack Obama. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I can only imagine that publisher is just like, oh, I can't believe I didn't put that picture in the book. It's one of those moments, one of those things. Anyhow, federal investigators are trying to figure out what went wrong with a U.S. Airways plane that went down in New York's Hudson River. Everyone survived. And so this morning we've been getting amazing stories about catastrophic situations that actually turned out well.
Hi, this is Steve from Manhattan. When I was 18, I fractured my neck. I was immediately paralyzed from the neck down, barely able to breathe. And all this was in upstate New York, 45 miles away from the nearest major hospital. Got there in time. Doctors saved my life. 50 years later, I'm a practicing entertainment lawyer with a son who's a doctor.
That's extraordinary. We want to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji. Todd Zwillick is in for John Hockenberry.
Go, go, Todd Zwillick!
And this is The Takeaway.
The The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway